I'm Steve Seal from Minnesota Public Radio. It is my pleasure once again to welcome you to Policy and a Pint, our 11th year, at least, I think, right? We're doing this, but thank you. Our 11th year of doing these programs. From the very beginning, these have been collaborations with the Citizens League, a wonderful organization here in town that I would encourage you to investigate, Google them, find them online, get involved. They are our intrepid partners in these productions. It's a co-production of the Citizens League and 89.3 The Current. And Target is, once again this year, our institutional sponsor. Thank you so much to Target for sponsoring Policy and a Pint. And our title this time out, Moving Our Mental Health System Forward, is what we're calling this program tonight. And we're talking specifically about the mental health care in Minnesota tonight. Mental illness affects at least one in five people at some time in their lives. And improving our mental health system of care is one of the biggest public health challenges that we have in the United States and in Minnesota as well. In Minnesota alone, according to a statement from Governor Dayton's office recently, over 200,000 adults and 75,000 children in Minnesota live with some form of mental illness, and people wait. This is what's really staggering to me, although not surprising, sadly, at the same time somehow. People wait an average of 10 years between the onset of symptoms before seeking out treatment. When does that happen in physical health? It doesn't. So that's one of the many, many things that I want to get into tonight. I wouldn't be surprised if a lot of people in this room would acknowledge both that mental illness in some way has affected their lives, either themselves or someone that they love, and that there was at least some degree of challenge in addressing that situation, either through the difficulty in diagnosing the problem or finding adequate care or both. Although we know a lot about what works in mental health care and treatment and community supports, many people receive little or no treatment, resulting in poor outcomes, in many cases ending up homeless or in the criminal justice system. And of course, suicide is still a major problem that affects our state and our country. And yet, despite years of work, we still don't treat mental illness like other health care conditions. And this impacts policies. It impacts funding. So tonight, I want to ask, while we have the foundation for a better mental health care system, such as it is, we'll find out if there is a system, what are the barriers to meeting the demand for mental health treatment and supports when funding and the needed workforce is in short supply? And what can we do about it here in Minnesota in particular? What do we do about it collectively? What can we do about it as individuals? So, having said that, I'd like to introduce our guests who I'm so pleased could be here tonight. Sue Aberholden is Executive Director for NAMI Minnesota. That is the National Alliance on Mental Illness, the Minnesota chapter. For the last 14 years, she's led changes in public policies, created educational opportunities, and sparked support networks, helping to transform public attitudes and perceptions about people with mental illnesses. She also has worked for the PACER Center, ARC, and former U.S. Senator Paul Wellstone. Yes, we'll hold till the end, but no, go ahead, why not? I usually say hold to the end, but we'll go ahead. Bruce Suter, MD, is a consultant assistant professor of psychiatry at the Mayo Clinic in Rochester. He has been practice chair for the Department of Psychiatry and Psychology at Mayo since 2011. And currently serves on the Governor's Task Force for Mental Health. A native Minnesotan, Dr. Suter graduated from Mayo Medical School and completed his residency training in psychiatry at the Mayo Clinic. His research interests include management of behavioral problems in dementia patients and also electroconvulsive therapy, which is fascinating to me as well. Thank you, Bruce, for being here. Dr. Bruce Suter from Mayo. (Clears throat) And the Reverend Alfred Babington Johnson is the founder and CEO of the Stairstep Foundation, with a mission to reignite the spirit of community among African Americans. Stairstep facilitates the largest ecumenical collaboration of African American churches in Minnesota. His works united. More than 150 congregations are connected through the HWU Policy Board, consisting of the heads of communion of all the major African American denominations. The latest initiative of HWU is a focus on community wellness, violence reduction, and elimination of mental illness stigma. Babington is an ordained minister with a bachelor's degree in political science from Howard University and a Master of Divinity degree from Bethel Seminary. Thank you, Babington, for being here tonight. How this works, by the way, the format of Policy in a Pint is that I'll talk to our guests here for about the first half an hour. We're getting a little bit of a late start here tonight, so that'll take us to about 10 till, and then for the subsequent half an hour, assuming we can do that, we can go until 20 past, I'm hoping, then I'll take your questions. So be thinking of your questions as we go, and it's a big part of what we do here is hearing from you, asking, not me, obviously, our guests. I just hold the microphone. And also, if you want to tweet your questions as well, the hashtag is policypint, just one word. We are recording this, by the way. It's probably not going to air on the radio, but it will be available for a streaming on demand in a few weeks. That's how it generally works. So the goal of our discussion here, a snapshot of Minnesota's mental health system. I want to start with a quote from you, Sue, because it's a very provocative quote. It's interesting to me. You said, our mental health system isn't broken. It's never been built. Why was it never been built? Are you referring to nationally or in Minnesota or both? And what is it that has never been built? What do you mean?
So it's both, state mm-hmm. and national. You have to have a system in order for it to be broken, and we never built one. So when the institutions were closed very rapidly in Minnesota and across the country, for good reasons, I just might want to add, because they weren't great places to be, we never actually built the community mental health system. President Kennedy had actually signed a bill to create community mental health systems, but then the funding was drastically cut by first President Nixon, and then by President Reagan, who took the rest of it and made it a block grant, sent it out to states with actually no strings attached, and no one knew what happened to that money. On top of that, when Medicaid and Medicare were passed, they have discriminatory practices and policies against treatment for mental illness, and of course, private insurance doesn't pay for it. So if you don't have insurance paying for mental health treatment, there is no way to build a system.
Now, what do you mean by discriminatory practices against? What did you say?
So Medicaid, for example, will not pay for any residential treatment that's over 16 beds where over half of the people live with a mental illness. So Anoka Regional Treatment Facility right now that has 100 beds, we cannot use Medicaid for those dollars.
Wow.
When we created community services, for example, for people with developmental disabilities when they were moving out of the institutions, the federal government created what was called waivered services. And what they said is you can take the Medicaid money you were using in the institution and move it to the community. But we didn't have any Medicaid dollars in the institutions for people with mental illness, so we had no money to move over. Medicare has a lifetime limit on the number of inpatient psychiatric bed days that it will pay for. There is no limit on any other healthcare issue, only mental illness.
Okay, so you've already painted a very vivid picture of this vast disparity between how we conceive of mental health as compared to physical health. So when we talk about mental health, you know, we do that, I feel like we know what it means, like we think we know what that term means. But there seems to be potentially a real misunderstanding about mental illness. Why is mental health thought about differently than physical health? Bruce, do you want to tackle that one?
Well, I think it comes in part from the longstanding stigma and fear that's associated with mental health and mental illness. I mean, when you think back before we had many of the therapies that we have now, people, the mental health system was people chained to walls in asylums. And I think that culturally, that is still a picture that we have in our minds of what people with mental illness have. So I think that that's a piece of the difference of how people think about mental illness. I mean, people with mental illnesses were thought of as being witches or possessed or, you know, those sorts of things. And I think that those remnants and fragments still persist. And I think that along with that, and I want to mention the issue of fear as it pertains to mental illness, and inappropriately, people have a great fear of this. And when you think about it in this country, we associate people with mental illnesses and events. When we think of it, we think of Sandy Hook. We think of, you know, what happens in some of these other places, and that is a pretty sexy story to tell on TV. It's a lot less sexy to tell a story of somebody who has paranoid schizophrenia, who's been able to be on proper medication and live and exist in the community and do well, and to work in a sheltered work environment. We don't think of that when we think of mental illness. We think of, as a society, of those other things, and I think that's a piece of it.
Wow. You know, this is one of the things that's fascinating to me about this is that I had a conversation with a friend recently about this, and that somebody had maintained on Facebook, and these are friends of mine who are in their, you know, who are maybe 30 and even 30 years old, and one of them had made a reference to the stigma that surrounds mental illness. Because of that, my boyfriend is afraid to go get treatment. And I thought, are you kidding me? I thought we had gotten beyond this. I thought that, like what you just cited, Bruce, as being something that the stigma that certainly used to be in a preponderance of belief in mental illness being these sort of horrific images, I thought, surely this is just, we've gotten so far beyond that. But what you're maintaining is that we actually may have made baby steps in this, but there is still a stigma attached to mental illness in many ways.
Well, the public attitudes they're starting to change. People are starting to talk about it more. But just to give you one example, what swear words or slang words do we have for cancer or heart disease? None. What do we have for mental illness? Crazy, wacko, psycho. We have tons of them. And so that does make it hard. You have a young person who just learned that they have schizophrenia, and they say, I don't want anyone to know that I'm crazy. You know, it's that image again, and words are powerful. Every civil and human rights movement has owned their words, owned their language, and that's what we're trying to do. We don't want people to use those words, those slang words, to describe an illness that can have a devastating impact on your life.
Babington, is there talk about the stigma in the African American community in particular? What are the particular additional challenges that the African American community faces? Do we have 3 hours for that? Is that why you chuckled on that? But I mean, you know, there are additional challenges, I'm imagining, in this situation that African Americans have to overcome.
I chuckled, then my brow furrowed.
Yeah.
Because I found somehow in the question, a predisposition to the way we deal with things generally that's problematic, and that is trying to create silos of one kind or another, when point of fact, I think they all kind of run across all lines. I think the issue is a human issue. So if you want to talk about problems in respect to the African American community around anything, we can talk about that, lack of access, a variety of things, but I'm thinking that there's a deeper breakthrough we need to recognize the commonality of the challenge as opposed to what does it look like over here and what does it look like over there, because I think it really at core is the same thing. The notion that we are afraid of one another in one way or another. And, you know, I was thinking as Sue talked about the fact that it hasn't been broken, it was
never built, yeah.
And so into my mind came an expression that I heard recently about, I think it was about how you determine when civilization began. And someone pointed out that the real marker was when they found bodies or something that had healed bones. In other words, at some point, if there was no connectivity to people, and if you broke your leg, you would be devoured by animals or whatever it might be, because you were just, that's it for you. But at some point, there began to be a connectedness that allowed people to say, oh, you broke your bone, let's take you over here, let's let you heal. I think there's something about mental illness that is consistent with that notion. We perhaps haven't become civilized yet in respect to this idea of recognizing mm-hmm. that we have challenges, and why don't we, as we discover challenges, find ways to bring people aside and nurture and heal, whether they're African Americans or other.
Mm-hmm. What are the ways that we should see that we should approach notions of mental illness and physical illness in the same ways? And are there ways that we should approach them differently?
Go ahead. Well, we're all people. Mm-hmm. That's the breakthrough. You know, as long as we keep defining ourselves as other.
Yeah, right. Well, but as far as the difference between approaching treating right. mental illness or treating physical illness, I'm no longer talking about, you know, separating people into groups or silos, but I just mean in the treatment.
Well,
you know.
Our head is connected to the rest of our body.
Sure.
And so, you know, trying to do it differently, we don't really need to do that. The only thing that would be different is that we want to make sure that our system doesn't have the barriers to access. For example, because we have a workforce shortage, we really need schooling to mental health so that children can access the treatment right there. A family doesn't have to worry about transportation, taking off of work, all those kinds of things. So it makes it easier for them to access. But we know that in some communities, having you know, just regular health clinics in the schools helps kids do better in school as well. So other than that, though, we have to treat it the same way.
Yeah, go ahead, Bruce.
So I think that one piece that is a bit different, and you know, obviously we are biological organisms and the brain is an organ, but I think that one of the things that that people struggle with as individuals with these illnesses is, if I have diabetes, it doesn't feel as personal as if I have a significant anxiety disorder.
Wow, that is so profound. Yeah, I never thought about that before.
I guess the one thing that I would add to that, however, is that when we think of treatments in mental health, we think of the biopsychosocial model, the biological, the social, the person's psychological makeup as how we approach assessing and helping people. And I think that we do the same within other aspects of medicine. When somebody's got diabetes, the answer isn't just take your insulin, it's manage your weight. Manage your diet, healthy exercise. And I think that one of the struggles that I see as a psychiatrist is that we have gone from, we're getting too reductionistic and looking at it just as the brain biochemistry and what the medicine can be doing, as opposed to how do I take care of managing my life? How do I manage the stresses? How do I, as a person, my own personal psychology, respond to my world? And I think that too much in psychiatry, it's, you know, I've got 15 minutes. Oh, here, what's your symptom checklist? And here's your medications. So I really hope that as we move forward with different models of mental health care, is that those of us in psychiatry who do the prescribing really need to not ignore the other aspects of things, just like our other physician colleagues should not ignore diet and exercise and those things for diabetes.
Let's talk about access to care. I want to know about the challenges that we face getting the proper access to care that we need. Are the providers there? Do we know how to connect those who need the services with the providers? What are the particular challenges within, you know, from population to population and getting access to care. Sue.
Well, we have a huge workforce shortage, not just psychiatry, but up and down the continuum, whether it's behavioral health aides to licensed clinical social workers, you know, it's just across the board, we have a shortage. Nearly every single county in Minnesota is deemed a workforce shortage area.
Do people not want to go into this field?
We have people who would like to go in, but there aren't enough residency programs. And in some situations, what the person has to actually do is pay someone to supervise them, and then they work for free. And not everyone can work for free. And so we need to really change that up. And the payment rates are low. And so that also makes it difficult in terms of being able to, you know, pay back your student loans and really, you know, be able to live.
Mm-hmm. One of the terms that I hear in reading about problems with access to care is this idea of beds. There aren't enough beds for the patients who need the services. And I have a sense that this is not your favorite approach to it, Sue. So I want to let this be a sort of way in to talking about this. First of all, Bruce, you are very much of a of the mind that, well, no, this is a problem. Right? We don't have places for people who need the care to go, right?
I would view it as a symptom of a larger problem.
Okay, what's that?
So if I look at it as, so right now I would bet that across the state of Minnesota there are, you know, give or take 100 people in emergency departments or in other medical type settings that are awaiting placement in a psychiatric facility or bed. So if you look at it, you can say, yep, there's not enough beds, but we are not going to build our way out of this problem. And so I think that if one, so there's two ways of looking at, are there enough beds? One is to say we need to build more beds so these people have a place to go. And I think in the short term, I would say we need to have places for these people to go and get the care that they need. Without that, I think that it is happening, that people who need to get emergency care aren't getting the care, because if I go to the emergency room, how long am I going to have to sit there? I mean, if I go to the emergency room for something that I've gone for and wait there, you know, for 2 hours, it's like, oh, I can't stand it, you know, I hurt my knee. Well, 2 hours is nothing when you compare looking at people staying in an emergency department for many days, many nights. The other piece of this, though, is that I think that, so maybe we could say, gee, maybe we don't have enough emergency room beds then. The problem is, so we'll know when we have enough services and appropriate services and care and preventive care in the state of Minnesota when the emergency rooms stop filling up with people. So I would say that in the acute situation, yes, we do, but the issue is that the preventive services and all the things that keep people from getting as ill as they get don't exist, and that's why we need more beds.
Okay. So, yeah, you wanted to jump in.
Yes. Well, everyone would love to have a nice silver bullet to say this is what's going to fix the mental health system, this is what's going to build it. And beds, the most expensive part of our system, is not necessarily the answer. So let's talk about how long does it take for someone when they start experiencing symptoms to even get an appointment. So I had a young man last week who was experiencing symptoms of schizophrenia, and he told he could get in 3 months. Let's look at urgent care. Urgent cares have been developed to keep people out of the emergency room. I have yet to find an urgent care that has a mental health professional. So, you know, then we get people into the emergency room, right? And then the Minnesota Hospital Association just did a study that said that 20% of the people in the inpatient beds right now don't need that level of care, and most of them are waiting for the community. Then we go to the Anoka Metro Regional Treatment Center, which is where people normally would go after if they need longer-term treatment. And depending on the day, 30 to 50% of the people there are waiting for community services. So in some ways, it's a flow issue. The other thing I want to mention, though, is that 10 years ago, we were barely serving 40% of the people. Today, we have more people than ever wanting to receive treatment. So it's not just, do we have enough services for people? We've been building our system. At the same time, we have more people seeking treatment than ever before.
Is this health exchanges that's doing this, or what is the reason?
I think it's just awareness.
Awareness.
And people feeling like, yes, maybe I should go get help, or their family or coworkers or friends saying, you know, you should go seek out help.
Babington, yeah, I wanted to ask about mental health first aid as well. Is something, is that what you, but go ahead.
Well, yes. I mean, I think even as we talking about this, yeah. It occurred to me that for me, this and other situations are going to be more informative than anything else. And that's what we need. Sue has been waging this war for a long time to try to raise the awareness of the entire state, the country, on these issues. So if you look at the spectrum of mental health issues, from panic attacks to schizophrenia or whatever it might be, we all need a little bit of help. And so the issue of urgent care is about urgent care. You know, when you have a major accident and someone is bleeding to death, they need urgent care. But mental CPR and other kinds of first responder activities are more and more prevalent on physical issues, but not on the issues of mental health. And so to the notion of mental health first aid, I feel almost embarrassed to say that I just learned of this year.
And this is something that you have been practicing?
We're now involved.
Okay. So tell us about that.
But earlier this year, through Ann Ellison of Fairview Health Services, she knew that we at Stairstep are really trying to engage the community about a range of things, showing the efficacy of the church network to deal with a variety of issues. And right now, when you look at the headlines, you see all the violence that is now captivating in relation to the African American community, whether that's blue on black or black on black. The violence is a major issue. Doug Kaepernick is kneeling, and Doug Baldwin, Colin Kaepernick. And Doug Baldwin is locking arms. But the point is, this is a focus issue. And so as we looked at this issue, we said, you know, this violence is not really the deal. This is a presenting issue that gives us an opportunity to get beneath it and look at other issues, whether that's education or economics or trauma. Our community is sitting in a bowl of trauma. And whether that's loss of job or relationship loss or whatever it might be, trauma impacts and people act out as a consequence of it. Where do you get help for that? And so what Ann brought to us was the fact that there is this learning called mental health first aid, the development of first responders around mental health issues. And it's an 8-hour training from which you come with certificates that then allow you to be better able to listen non-judgmentally and to help people find internal and external helps and what have you. And so we have determined that there is a need in our community to increase capacity for first responders around mental health issues. And we are launching on that. In addition to the need for urgent care and psychologists, we need more and more of us to be aware of the fact that these are common issues, and all of us need to be more alert to how to cope with the immediacy of the problem.
How much is the clergy taking up the slack in the African American community for connectivity and services, basically?
Well, historically, the African American church was the game for African American people, whereas other communities had a variety of leaders popping up all over out of, you know, industry and politics and what have you. For African Americans, it's often been the church and the pastor. Things have become more marginalized in respect to the church, but the church has still got the historical credibility. It still is ubiquitous. Everywhere you look, we got a church, whether it's a storefront or a cathedral. So the opportunity of service through the church is a ripe opportunity. And we intend to take advantage of that to increase the capacity of the churches, pastors, lay people, and everyone, but using that as a vehicle, if you will.
All right, question here.
Yeah, I'm just curious if there are kind of local or global examples that you guys have seen that have effective health systems in place for treatment of mental illness, and what can we learn from those?
So, no. What we see are pockets. Like, someone did something good with kids in school. Someone did something good with first episode psychosis. Someone's doing good, but there is not another state that I would move to or another country. I'm connected on social media with advocacy groups across the world, and everyone is complaining, and everyone is talking about how they can't access services when and where they need them.
I would agree. I think there are pockets of services that are done very well. I mean, we know a lot of things that work well. Teams that go out and meet with folks in their community, in their homes, arms workers, people who provide services, housing that has mental health services built right into the housing. So there are lots of different programs out there that work, but that and some areas of the state of Minnesota are better at getting grant money than other areas of the state, and so a pocket in southeast Minnesota might have services that aren't available in northwest Minnesota, and so I think that each of the counties have developed. Services differently, and some have done a good job of developing services that meet some of the needs within their community. But when Sue talks about the array of services that are needed, that full array isn't there consistently. So this isn't I don't think that this is an issue of not knowing things that work and work well. It's developing those services, paying for those services, and getting people to provide those services in the locations where they're needed.
Got our next question over here.
This is a more specific for Dr. Suter, but curious with your interest in electroconvulsive therapy. What is that? I think people kind of get the idea of, you know, the 60s horror movie, the idea of torture. What exactly does that entail, and is that a treatment that's still taking place? Does that kind of have anything to do with the emerging field of transcranial magnetic stimulation, things like that?
So I purposely put that in there, partly because it's true, but partly because there is a huge amount of stigma as it pertains to electroconvulsive therapy. I know of no other therapy that is as rapidly effective and yet as poorly misunderstood in our culture and feared than ECT. I use the analogy of what we see on television and in movies. So imagine, let's say I needed my appendix taken out, and all of a sudden four big burly guys grab me, throw me down on a table, don't give me anesthesia, rip out my appendix, and then hold it up in front of me. I mean, that's how silly the portrayal of this very effective treatment is in the media and in our society.
Yeah.
I guess I have a couple things. One of the things I would like to say is I really think that there should be somebody up there that has experienced the mental health system on their own, and I guess on the other side of it as a patient, because I think that would be really informative.
I am a family member.
All right, cool.
Yeah. So.
And then my other question is I guess my whole entire problem with a lot of this system, I guess, as I've experienced it with both friends and family and stuff, is that there's certain times when it's very serious and we have to wait for that, but I think there should be some interim place for that, because otherwise I've also seen people being locked up for too long when they're already okay and they can't seem to get out of the system as well. So I think there's like a problem there as well, and I'm wondering what you guys can talk to or say about that.
Thank you.
One of the new things that have been developed over the last couple of years are crisis homes. So people might not necessarily, you know, just because you go to the emergency room doesn't mean you need to be hospitalized. And so for people who don't, a crisis home is often better. They aren't worried about being committed. It's more home-like. It's a place where they can kind of, you know, be nurtured and taken care of and kind of work on their mental health. And we just need a lot more of them across the state, but they've been very effective in helping people in those situations.
Yeah.
Bruce? I could not agree more.
Hi, I wonder, I've heard a lot about different employers becoming more inclusive of people with mental health issues in the community, and I'm wondering if you could give a to-do list to employers and supervisors on how to make the workplace more inclusive, more friendly to people with mental illness, what would you put on that to-do list?
I love that question, that's excellent.
It would be a really long list. So people with mental illness have one of the highest unemployment rates, and we actually have a lunch and learn for employers. And what we found is that virtually none of them know what an accommodation is for mental illness. They know what to do if someone comes in a wheelchair. They have no idea if someone, you know, that has even been employed there and now their symptoms have returned. So a couple things there. One is really stressing work-life balance, which is not anything I can talk to. but, you know, stopping the emails at 6 o'clock, you know, those kinds of things so that people don't have that all the time. Another thing is making sure that you know what the accommodations are. A third thing is really looking at what does your insurance cover? You know, if it's a self-insured plan, do you really cover the array of treatment options that people actually need? And then making sure that people have time to actually take off of work to visit their therapist or go to their psychiatrist or take care of their family member there so that they can work on getting well.
I have another question right over here. All right, I'll get to you in a second.
I live in Scott County, and we have a, an action where we are getting all of our police sheriffs and city police officers trained in crisis intervention training. And I'm just wondering if that is something that is being looked at legislatively as maybe a model for a mandatory model. And
So Sue is the poster child for this initiative.
We actually had a bill this last session that would start out just requiring 4 hours of their 48 hours to be on de-escalation training in mental illnesses. We did get it passed in the Senate bill, but we couldn't get the House to accept it. We'd love to have the 40-hour requirement for the training, but, you know, I know birds don't fly into the wind. So we'll start out with 4 hours. And what we know even from teachers, because we were the first state in the country to require teachers to have continuing education on the early warning signs of mental illness in children. And what we saw is when they got a little bit of training, they learned how much they didn't know and wanted to seek out more. So if we could start with four, that would be a great base.
I want to thank you for bringing that question up because I think it is just so important. As my wife and I were watching the news with the situation in North Carolina recently, and my wife, who is not a mental health professional, was watching that, and she was like, why are these people continuing to push and push and push this person? Why don't they take a step back? You know, what was it about the situation with that gentleman that required the police to need to take control of the situation right now? Which is what it looked like, certainly to me. And if they had had this training, maybe they would have backed off a little bit, let the situation de-escalate, and actually find out what's going on without having to take control of the situation. I'm not faulting officers for what they have to deal with. I don't have to worry about getting killed every day I go to work. But I think that this training is just so critically important to people living.
You know, I think that it's important to understand that no institution of the state, the government, can solve the issues that they're confronted with, whether that's the school solving education or the police solving crime. It can't be done unless the community itself provides the support, the nurturing environment that allows effective activity. So even on this issue of mental health and dealing with it, we can continue to sort of push it off to the medical professionals or the police or whoever it might be. But in point of fact, the solution will happen when we all engage around better understanding of what's going on and creating that environment that allows progress.
All right, next question here.
I'm curious about your thoughts on how insurance requirements for mental health diagnosis and evidence-based practice have become a barrier to both the access and provision of mental health services.
Well, I think it's, oddly, I think things are getting better. It's not great, but things are moving in the right direction. I think, you know, comparing with where things were 15 years ago, 20 years ago, I think insurance has a better recognition. I think that there's a better recognition that coverage needs to exist, and maybe we'll get to parity someday. But I think the piece where the biggest barrier is the the one size fits all, you need to have this degree of symptoms, this degree of problem to get this level of service. And I think that that is a big problem. I can't get care unless I'm really sick, and then when I'm really sick, when I start to get better, I now have to be thrust out of that care, and that's a barrier.
Can you lay out for us what exactly has changed, what she's referring to?
Well, I think that prior to parity, there was differential coverage for medical illness and physical illness. So that, as an example, in the organization that I work for, you could have 40 visits a year. That was it. You're done. Well, there's no limit on 40 physical therapy visits. There's no limit on, somebody needing to go see their oncologist or yeah. getting their radiation treatments and those things. So with parity, some of those barriers, there's other barriers, but some of those things were taken down. But I do not see the level of scrutiny on the physical health side of things, particularly for hospitalization. And limiting the care for physical health in the same degree that it is for mental health.
That brings up a couple of questions for me. First of all, when you say parity, you just mean equivalent amount of care between mental health and physical health care? Is that what you mean? Now, what do you mean by parity?
Actually, the mental health parity law does not require insurance companies to cover mental health or substance use disorder treatment. It just says if you cover it, you have to do it in the same way. So you can't have different out-of-pocket costs. You can't put arbitrary limits on the number of visits. And then it has a third component that has really never been enforced, which is they call it non-quantitative treatment limits. So you have to pay for like services. So for example, if the insurance company will pay for nursing home rehab because you got your hip replaced, it should pay for residential treatment for someone who is leaving the hospital with schizophrenia. But they don't do that part, but they'll do the nursing
okay.
home.
Okay. Now what, and why did it used to be, and still is in some cases, I guess, is what I'm discerning, that there is a limited number of visits you get to your therapist per year or whatnot. Are you saying that has been taken care of and that doesn't exist anymore, or that still happens in some cases?
It still happens.
Okay, and why is that?
Because people need to fight back to their insurance companies,
okay,
and it's not
right.
an easy thing to do when you're not feeling well.
Yeah, right, because they could get away with it, is what you're saying, insurance companies.
Yes.
Okay, all right then. Well, we've got that on record. All right. All right.
So, but one of the things as it pertains to parity that I have seen is happening, you can look at parity two ways, and I'm not going to be able to do this with the microphone. Parity can be this. So parity can be this. This is physical health. This is mental health. You can do that, or you can do that. And, mm-hmm. And I think that there's a bit of both going on.
Okay. Got it. Thank you.
The comparison was made early on between physical health and mental health, but there's an important distinction in that if I fall and break my leg and I'm in serious pain, chances are I'm going to seek medical attention, whereas with mental illness, a lot of times the person's judgment is seriously impaired, and one of the things that I see as a huge problem is that family members who try to seek help for an adult individual with serious mental illness problems are treated as suspect and as though they have an ulterior motive. They're often treated very hostily. What do we do with that? How do you seek care for a loved one who isn't cooperative but seriously needs attention?
Huge issue, yeah.
So I suggest to family members and to the patients that I care for, in times when they are feeling better is the time to start planning for when they may not be. And so psychiatric advanced care directives that say this person has the ability to make decisions for me if I'm viewed as not being capable of doing this themselves. So that's one way of addressing this. But in the crisis in the moment, it's really difficult.
So we like to go out and talk to mental health professionals and tell them that HIPAA does not require them to be stupid. And what we see all the time, what we see all the time is that, you know, a family member brings someone into the emergency room, they get hospitalized, they call back later to say, how is the person doing? And they say, we can't tell you if they're here or not. And you're like, seriously? We were just there with them. And I think that any mental health professional can't get the full picture unless they actually talk to the families. And the other thing that I've seen, and I work with, you know, I've done work with disabilities, did respite care and things like that, and they're treated so differently. We understand that when a family has a child with serious disabilities and multiple disabilities, that they're gonna look like a wreck, right? They are emotionally and financially strained. But we don't look at it the same way when you have someone with a serious mental illness and not understanding that you're going to be emotionally and financially drained as well. And so they look at the family coming in who's been trying to deal with this crisis at home. They're a wreck, and they say, well, the apple doesn't fall far from the tree, instead of actually saying, my gosh, this family is in crisis. We need to help.
You know, it seems to me I'm really encouraged just by this gathering, because we need to all understand this more, whether it's the individual themselves who's starting to experiencing things that they don't think are quite right, but because of the stigma that's attached and the insensitivity that we generally have to this issue, they don't respond themselves early enough, nor does the family recognize it without thinking that they don't want anybody, we'll lock them upstairs, you know, so because we don't want anybody to know we've got a little strangeness going on in our homes. So I think another part of this continues to be the intentionality with which we inform ourselves as a community around these issues so we can move to another level of sensitivity.
Got a next question here.
Hi, I'm a psychiatric nurse for the last 20 years, and I am this close to becoming a prescriber. I'm just about to graduate. I wanted to bring up another situation that I think is also a barrier to care. I just worked with somebody recently who is schizophrenic. She was seeing a psychiatrist and receiving therapy for one place. Her psychiatrist left, and she called, and she was told, well, your psychiatrist left. And she said, I need someone else. And they said, we're not taking new patients. And so this is like, I'm just saying, here's another way in which it becomes very hard to keep yourself well.
It's a huge problem. And, you know, we can't invent more more slots when they don't, more appointment slots when they don't exist, and we can't invent more prescribers when they aren't there. And if you're looking for a job, please call me.
Okay. Yeah, questions coming in. We have about, we can take at least another 10 minutes here, I'd say. Right over here? Okay.
I'd like to shamelessly plug for myself. I'm a prescriber, and I would like a job.
All right. Well, you know where to go. Yes.
What's happening in the schools, and I mean elementary, middle schools, high schools, and colleges for early detection of mental illness of all types?
It was right here. It was right here on the notes. I was going to get to it, I promise. Excellent question. I know you guys want to talk about that.
So we have a great program in Minnesota, and it's in about 85% of the school districts and about 40 to 50% of the actual school buildings. And the grants actually go out to mental health providers who then co-locate and collaborate in the schools. So the children can get services right there and don't have to leave the classroom for long. And most of the programs started in elementary schools so that we're addressing issues early and then slowly moving up into the high schools. So I think that's a really big thing. And the teachers, of course, have to have training. And this last session, they now have to have an additional 1 hour training on suicide prevention so that they get that piece too. We need more school support personnel as well, not just school counselors, but school social workers, school psychologists, school nurses, CD counselors, so that, you know, they can work with kids who are in the very early stages, but then kids who really need treatment can get it through these school-linked mental health clinics.
So but I think it was about a year and a half ago, the Tribune did a big series on the Child Protective Services and the lack of emergency, I'm blanking on the term, emergency housing and foster care for kids. The importance of recognizing when family systems are stressed and when children are stressed early is incredibly important. If we're gonna look at solving this problem, we have to start looking at preventive measures with kids. And the reason for that is, and I'm not a big statistic quoter, but I heard this today and thought, I gotta bring this up. So if you look at levels of trauma, events that happen as kids, the more events there are, the more likely that someone is going to have depression problems, anxiety problems as an adult. If one has had seven of these events, there's a 35% chance, lifetime chance, that the person will go on and attempt suicide. It's huge. And if you think of these families, how many kids in difficult families, difficult circumstances, have at least seven events that are traumatic in their lifetime? It's huge. So understanding, identifying these folks early, intervening early to prevent these traumas from happening is what's going to keep the next generation healthier.
Also, there seems to be a, you know, such a change in the drugs that are available to young people today as opposed to just 20 years ago during a time when, you know, critical brain development is going on, and it seems to me that that's got to be making a difference as well. Bruce?
So,
Babington?
I grew up in Marshall, Minnesota, and when I was growing up, I mean, we had, sure, there was stuff around, but what you were going to be exposed to typically was, you know, a little bit of Minnesota ditchweed and 3-2 Schlitz. I could have been exposed to it, I wasn't. But the point...
The sounds of it, you've never had either of those things.
The point being that... So the point being that adolescents and young adults are who they are, and they are going to imbibe what's put in front of them. And unfortunately, what happens is with the really high potency, very inexpensive designer drugs, narcotics, the other things that are out there, it's the same risky behavior, but with a lot higher consequences. And I think that we're seeing that in terms of brain development. I think that people from a psychosocial standpoint sort of stop emotional development at the time when they start using these things in a problematic way. And that so we see that having a huge effect upon destabilization of folks with mental illness, and frankly, I think with what happens with brain development, I think there's a causative effect there as well.
Next question here. Or did you want to? Anybody? All right, we're good.
Thank you. I am very interested. I'm very glad that you brought up. You can bring it up. Sorry. That's okay. that trauma came up, but I'm actually interested in the intersection of trauma and unconscious bias that is present in both systems that we've talked about today, both the healthcare system and the criminal justice system, and to think about, and I think to further complicate it, to the fact that the systems that you all have referenced, saying that there's not enough capacity in the system as it is to be able to meet the need that is out there. So I'm very interested in if there is room available for some complementary and alternative modalities to be introduced to try to look at mental health. Particularly, I'm concerned about this in Black and Brown communities where it's already happening, right? I call it, you know, there are many healers that are in the community. I really think about it as invisible emotional labor, right? But how is this work being done? How can we think about some economic support that could go that way? And if there are ideas that you all have about trying to be able to connect the mental health system as it is with some of these sort of non-mainstream ways of being able to address these issues, because it's happening, but people are not being supported economically to do the work.
Thank you.
I think that's such a helpful insight to raise the disconnect of economics to come for holistic activities that could occur in communities and what have you. And I hope perhaps Sue and Bruce can speak to that from their vantage. But let me just say that we are now trying to connect, we are connecting with the Black psychologists and the African-American clergy. And we're launching an effort to create a curriculum called Learned Self-Management, which we then hope to implement into the community using folk who I call village champions. You used an interesting term. What was the term you used about heal?
Invisible emotional labor? Yeah.
Yeah, wonderful. That's a great notion. Huh? And unpaid,
yeah,
absolutely.
Definitely.
But the point is, folks who are nurturing and caring in the community, and the degree to which we can increase intentionally the number of folk who are bringing those kinds of ideas into the community is a critically important thing. We're trying to do that in ways that are systematic, but the issue of getting the resources is an absolute challenge. No question.
So one idea that we're working on is a couple years ago we created peer specialists and then family peer specialists. So people with lived experience, because lived experience and sharing your knowledge can be so helpful. We're looking at changing the rules a little bit around that. So for example, an elder could become a peer specialist. Someone from a particular cultural community could be a peer specialist even if they didn't have a high school degree and those kinds of things, because of the importance of their knowledge. So that would be one way that people could get paid, by providing that kind of emotional support. And we need to change the law a little bit next session, but it's on all of our agendas.
Hi, I've worked in human services for almost 10 years, and my most recent position was with the school linked mental health. We've established that it's really good bringing that in at an elementary school, middle school age level to start addressing things. What if the parent does not want involvement? What if the parents are undocumented citizens that refuse to get the child help because they fear it coming back on them?
Wow, yeah, excellent question.
So that's a tough one. The grant monies can serve the families. I know that at least in some of the districts, they actually have a culturally specific provider who is doing the work in the schools to try to connect that way. One of the problems with actually our mental health system is that we require a diagnostic assessment very early on. So we have a bill for next session that will create an at-risk code, which means you can develop the relationship with that family, you can serve them, and do it for a while before you ever have to diagnose that child, because you might actually resolve the problem before you ever have to do it. So that might be one way to help with that, because we know that, especially with the families that you're talking about, they have a lot of valid fears about what's going to happen. So you can't just meet with them once and then ask all these questions. You need to develop that relationship. So I'm hoping that will help in the future.
I don't want schools to dominate the conversation, but I'm the chair of the board at a local high school. And last week we had a student commit suicide. And the response from the psychologist and from the principal was to address it and let people know that it happened, and then not glorify the situation at all or really acknowledge it beyond just announcing that it happened. And I'm curious how you think it's best to respond to a situation like that, and how their response is to protect the students, but how we can balance the stigma of not just ignoring the fact that it happened while also not making it appealing for those who are also suffering from mental health.
There's actually a class called Postvention that actually we have staff that teach, and they actually sounds like they did it the right way, because you don't want to memorialize it, you don't want to do that kind of thing, because you can it can actually lead to other kids then attempting to take their own lives. So it isn't that it's stigma, it's that you don't want to talk about the methods, you don't want to talk about the means, you don't want to do those kinds of things. And usually, typically, schools then have counselors available on site to talk to kids who may be worried about it. But it sounds to me like they actually did the right thing.
Yeah, I would agree. I think that having the availability of someone to talk with, not forcing the issue, but you know, you got to come talk to the counselor, but having it available for folks. So it sounds like, first of all, a horrible event, and I think you handled it properly.
I'll try to do this without feedback next to the speaker. Hopefully that works.
You've talked about a few bills that have come up in front of the legislature and then things you're going to be proposing this coming session. Generally, how would you describe the political environment around mental health issues in this state? Is it a favorite one? And then specifically, are there bills or organizations that citizens like us can track to make sure our legislators are doing the right thing?
NAMI.
So, yes, we have a legislative update that comes out every week during the session, so you know what's happening. I will say that generally our state has really done pretty well. We have been supported and screwed by both parties. And so often what matters is actually that you have a champion. I mean, if you think of Pete Domenici, who, you know, very conservative Republican, and Paul Wellstone, both working together on mental health parity. The biggest problem we run into is when people don't want to increase the budget or when we're facing, you know, huge budget deficits, you know, then we often get cut and it's hard to move something forward. But we truly have had champions from both parties and quite a few of them.
And I would like to point out that I think that the legislature, I would agree, I think that there's bipartisan recognition that there is a problem, a huge problem that needs something done. And I think that there have been efforts in the last few years. I mean, it's been, what, $100 million of money put forward in the last couple years. I think that what the legislature and what DHS is struggling with is, what do we do? I think that there's... Well, I think there's a recognition that something needs to be done, but what to do about it, I don't see as getting a lot of traction.
Oh, I do. I mean, we came in 2015 with a very clear path. This is what we need to do. This is how we need to continue to build our system. It was part of the governor's budget. Most of it passed. So I think for those of us who spent a lot of time over there, it was very clear in terms of what we needed to do to move forward.
What is the pie chart on how the state money gets divided up as far as what goes to what?
Well, a lot does go to human services, but a lot to education as well. The thing that you have to remember is...
Oh, I just mean with regards to mental health, I'm sorry.
But see, what we really started to do back in 2006 and 2007 is to move away from state block grants to counties to pay for treatment and put it in insurance under Medicaid and Minnesota Care so people don't have to wait in line for basic treatment. So then it becomes harder to say what part of the pie because it's part of the insurance.
I got you, yeah.
If I might add one thing, mm-hmm. Senator Bobby Champion often says, if you're not at the table, you're on the menu. Now, it was, if you're not there, if your voice isn't there, you're forgotten about or you're carved up. An indication of this occurred when Minsure first did its outreach. They had grants available to reach into communities that ostensibly were impacted. Both the mental health work that NAMI was doing and the entire African American community were absolutely ignored. We had to fight desperately just to get the ability to do outreach for mental illness populations and for African Americans, what have you. So it's critical. The work that just standing ovation for Suiter, persistence and consistency. But if we don't all raise these issues, they're just ignored.
Yeah. Next question here.
Hi, my name's Howard Hansen, and March 1st of 2009. I read a book that had just been published by Jody Allen Crow about fetal alcohol syndrome, and I'm quite disappointed that it hasn't even been mentioned here as something leading up to mental health problems and a lot of other problems, violence, gun violence. But this issue has been censored in the media. I have, since March 1st, 7 years ago, 7.5 years ago, I've sent out hundreds and hand-delivered these books to legislative leaders, to editors at the Star Tribune, to public officials, and it gets no discussion or debate. And like 4 or 5 years ago, they said in the last decade, this had increased 700% or some really terrible. It's an epidemic.
Why don't we let our panelists check in on fetal alcohol syndrome and see that you bet.
Yeah. So I think that's an important, it's an important specific issue. I'll speak to the general issue, which anything that we can do to support maternal health, healthy pregnancies, is going to do nothing but help with preventing mental health problems and issues.
And I'll just say that MOFAS, which is the organization that focuses on this issue, is now part of the Mental Health Legislative Network. We've supported them on their bill. They had a bill that passed that actually required foster parents to have training on fetal alcohol disorders. So there is some movement. The problem is they don't necessarily fit into a particular bucket. Some don't meet the developmental disability criteria, some don't meet the mental illness criteria, and so they're kind of lost. And so, but we've been working closely with MOFAS to try to help move things forward.
We had a question come in on Twitter, which was really what I was going to sort of wrap up with, which was, what would you guys like individually to sort of send us out of the room thinking about or with an action for each of us to do individually? I think we've developed a lot of interest, even more interest in this issue tonight than many of us had even coming in here tonight. Where should we go? What should we do first?
Well, since I'm the least knowledgeable on these matters, let me just throw my piece in first. And that is, recently the Center for Disease Control in Atlanta developed a program, I Can Prevent Diabetes, that recognized the horrific gateway that diabetes is to all kinds of difficulties that people experience. And this curriculum was helpful in preventing people getting diabetes. There was a collective impact in the state of Minnesota to try to get vendors to pay for the I Can Prevent Diabetes program and more people to take it. I think this issue of mental health first aid is an important learning and a capacity building thing for the entire community. And I wish all of you would seek out ways for you and your institutions and people, your churches and what have you, to start to take the mental health first aid training that we might all be better able to help each other.
That's actually a URL itself. There's a place you can go, just Google mental health first aid, and it's one of those websites. Bruce.
So the more knowledge that people have, the less fear people have. So I think the more that we can do to educate people about what mental illnesses are, who the people are who have them, that yes, they are people. And I have more hope for the state of Minnesota than I did 4 or 5 years ago, and I'll offer this example. And I think back again, Marshall, Minnesota, when I think of where we are now in the state of Minnesota, as it pertains to gay marriage. 40 years ago, we couldn't have had anywhere close to a conversation, let alone that this is something that is, that's there and it's great and it's terrific and there's still a long way to go. But I think the same can happen with mental illness, that we can as a society move to a place where that just plain can't happen and shouldn't happen and doesn't happen to a place where we as a society can be more accepting and understanding. And as we get there, then I think the systems will come with.
So I feel actually a great amount of hope for the future in terms of our mental health system. I'm one of those people that I look at a glass and I don't say it's half empty, it's half full. I'm just glad there's water in it. But I think there's two things for people. One is to reach out. So if you're experiencing symptoms, reach out to someone for help. If you have a family member or a friend who you can see is struggling, reach out to them and to help them. And then the last thing is to speak out. We need allies. We need people to join our movement to really make sure that legislators and others really understand that we need to continue to build our system. We need to make sure that people have better access to care and treatment and so that they can live full lives in our community.
I want to add a little something, and that is when you talk about a mental health population, it turns people who are suffering from some sort of mental illness into an other. When I was growing up, my parents spoke of people with mental illness as being some sort of other people. And the reason that I'm hopeful, as Sue is as well, is that more and more we don't do that as a society. We acknowledge that this is something like an injury, or like cancer, or like the flu, or whatever it may be, that you can come down with. And that's why I'm optimistic about it, too. And I think that this sort of dovetails with something that you like to say, Babington, which is that when you encounter people who are suffering, struggling in some way, you like to tell them, well, you're not in some sort of silo or bucket, so, you know, stricken with this, you can get better, right? Yeah, so that's why I'm optimistic as well. So I'd like to thank all of our guests. Can we give a big round of applause for all of our guests here tonight? And we do come down with these things, many of us. I want to thank Sue Eberholden, Alfred Babington Johnson, Dr. Bruce Suter for coming here tonight. The Citizens League, thank you again, 11 years. Let's do 11 more. Sean Kershaw, Pahua Hoffman, Jen Unstead from the Citizens League. From Minnesota Public Radio, my producer, Jane Solinger, thanks so much to Amanda Lilly for providing so much homework. Matt Perkins from The Current as well. Target is, once again this year, our institutional sponsor. Thank you so much to Target for sponsoring Policy and a Pint. Stay tuned, as always, for our announcement of our next topic. And it's great to see you. Thanks so much for participating. I'm Steve Seal. I'll see you on the radio.